Okay, let's continue the subject of Passover. We spoke about the mitzvah, the commandment of eating the leavened bread, the unleavened bread. Let's speak a little bit about the Paschal lamb. That's the offering that we were commanded to bring in Egypt. As a matter of fact, the commandment of the Paschal lamb, to bring the lamb to the temple, and it has to be eaten by every family, and families get together to eat it. This is the first obligation that the Jews as a nation were commanded to fulfill as far as sacrifices are concerned. This is the first sacrifice that the Jews were given as an obligation. Now, the idea of sacrifice in Judaism, we'll have a chance to speak a little bit more about it at another opportunity, but you know what the word in Hebrew for sacrifice is? The word in Hebrew for sacrifice is korban, korban. And you know what the word korban in Hebrew is related to? What other word relates to the word korban? Karov, karov. And you know what the word karov means? Near, near, right? Karov, near. Korban, something that brings you close. The purpose of the offering of the sacrifice in Judaism is as an expression, a physical expression of your feelings of closeness to God. You know that in Judaism, it's crucial that every emotion, every belief should be expressed in actions. It should not remain just in the world of ideas. Things which remain in the world of ideas cannot be established for too long. They dissipate, they disappear. An idea, an emotion, a belief has to be translated into actions. Somehow, by expressing it into actions, the action itself establishes the idea as part of the belief of the person. Therefore, the bringing, the offering of the Paschal lamb is considered the pact, a pact between Jews and God. Now, there are certain preconditions to the fulfillment of the mitzvah, the fulfillment of the commandment of the Paschal lamb, which we don't find by almost any other mitzvah in the Torah. For instance, we have a commandment to keep the Sabbath. Is there a precondition that only someone who is circumcised, for instance, he is the only one who can keep the Sabbath, or only a circumcised Jew can put on the phylacteries? Do we ever find such a concept? As a rule, we never find it. Mitzvot, commandments, are independent of each other. For instance, if you don't keep the Sabbath, can you still put on phylacteries during the week? Why not? One has nothing to do with the other. Mitzvot are independent commandments. We don't find too many mitzvot which depend on each other for its fulfillment. Here, the law of the Paschal lamb is an exception. By the law of the Paschal lamb, it says, anyone who is not circumcised is not allowed to partake in the commandment of the Paschal lamb. And the question is, why is the mitzvah of the Paschal lamb different than all the other mitzvot of the Torah, all the other commandments in the Torah? This is the first question. There is another question, on the surface unrelated, but we'll see from the answer that they are very closely related. Do you know that as a rule in the Torah, you know that we have positive commandments and negative commandments in the Torah? We have 613 biblical commandments. Out of those 613 commandments, we have 365 negative commandments. You shall not steal, you shall not kill, you shall not lie, whatever. Negative commandments. And we have 248 positive commandments, like believing in God, for instance, or many other positive commandments, putting on phylacteries, putting on the fringes. Those are the positive commandments. As a rule, in the Torah, whoever has a little bit of experience in the reading of the Torah, when do we find in the Torah punishments for transgressions? Only in negative commandments. We never find physical punishments or description of punishments for not fulfilling positive commandments. Even though it's wrong, a person should fulfill positive commandments, but we don't have in the Torah descriptions of punishments for positive commandments except for two. Is anyone aware which two positive commandments, their non-fulfillment brings about punishments mentioned in the Torah?
Circumcision.
Correct. Circumcision is one of them.
Sabbath.
No, Sabbath is also a negative commandment. Right? You shall not transgress. Right? You shall not do any creative work on the Sabbath. So one we mentioned is circumcision. The other one?
Burial.
What?
Burial?
No.
Eating
no. Well, not eating matzah, but not eating the Paschal lamb. If you have a chance to keep the Paschal lamb and you don't do it. So it's interesting. Which are the two exceptions to the rule? Again, circumcision and the Paschal lamb. So again, we see that there is something in common between circumcision and the Paschal lamb. What do they have in common? What is the thread that goes through both mitzvot, both commandments? What is it?
The
exactly. Exactly. So say the commentaries, what they have in common is that they are both pacts, commitments between God and the Jewish people and the Jewish people and God. As a matter of fact, pacts very often have one of the signs of a pact is blood. Not only by Jews, as a matter of fact, that was a common procedure when people used to make pacts with each other. Do you know, did you ever read? Right? They would draw blood as a sign of commitment. So that was an accepted way of behaving in the ancient world. A pact of blood. Circumcision, there is blood attached to the mitzvah. Drawing blood. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says if a person is born circumcised, you know that there is such a thing. Sometimes children are born circumcised. You still have to do a minimum fulfillment of the mitzvah, which is what? Drawing of blood. Right? So again, you see blood is attached to circumcision because it's a pact. Which other mitzvah has an attachment to blood, has an association with blood? The Paschal lamb. If you remember, they would smear blood on the doorposts in Egypt. So we see that they are both pacts. So the question is, why do you need two pacts? Why isn't it enough to have one mitzvah which expresses the idea of the pact between God and the Jew and the Jew and God? Yeah?
Could it be for the commandments, or there's two commandments, is it positive and there's a negative?
Well, but in this case, they are both positive commandments. So the commentaries say that the difference is the following. The Paschal lamb is given to the Jewish people when the Jewish people become a nation. When do the Jewish people become a nation? An official, separate body. In Egypt, even before that. In Egypt, when they come out of Egypt, they come out as a separate entity. The pact of circumcision was given to whom?
Abraham.
To Abraham, the single, the individual Jew. So in a way, we can see the two pacts in the following way. Circumcision expresses the pact between the individual Jew and God. This is why it's called the pact of Abraham, the single Jew. The Paschal lamb represents what? The pact of the Jew as a nation. Okay? Because the Jew has two parts. There is the individual Jew, the individual obligation of the Jew towards God. And then there is another side to it. The Jew as an integral part of that entity called the Jewish people. And as such, you also have a commitment to God. For instance, when we pray, and we pray as a group, right? There are certain prayers that you can't say unless you have a group of 10 Jews. Otherwise, you don't have a quorum. You don't have a minyan. Why? Because at that point, we have to act as a group, not as an individual. And it's interesting, you know that in Judaism, the number 10, again, what is the minimal quorum, the minimal amount of people that are described as a minimal group? 10 people. You know that in Judaism, we always find that numbers are never coincidental. It's never, for instance, that the world was created in 7 periods called days. It's not a coincidence. Could have been 8, could have been 6, it happened to be 7. Somehow, whenever we find the number 7, there is something which expresses the idea of creation, of nature, the cycle of nature. Do you know what the number 10 always represents?
Ten commandments.
Well, the Ten Commandments is just one of the many things which is associated with the number 10. The number 10, listen carefully to the words, then I'll explain to you the idea behind it. The number 10 is the first unit of parts. One is the unit. 10 is always the unit which is made out of parts. What does it mean? Do you know the Talmud mentions how many times the expression, and God said, let there be this, and God said, let there be that. How many times is it mentioned in Genesis that God created? You know how many times?
Ten times,
says the Talmud. What's the idea behind it? But there is one creator. Why couldn't he have created everything with one statement, with one saying? Because the idea is that the number 10 represents what seems to us on the surface as separate things. The purpose of the number 10 is to recognize the unity behind it. Whenever we want to stress the unity behind the parts, we find the number 10. What else is number 10? Our fingers, you say. Well, it's again not a coincidence that is our fingers represents what we do. But basically behind the fingers, there is one unit. It's myself. The Ten Commandments. Basically, you have one commandment. Fulfilling the will of God. That's the one commandment. But the one commandment breaks down into 10 parts. But behind the 10, there is the one. Okay? Or something else. The plagues in Egypt. What was the purpose of the plagues in Egypt? But the point was to recognize that everything which happens in the world, which on the surface, they are unconnected things that happen in the world. We have to find what's behind it. Behind the 10 is the hand of God, one. Which means 10 represents the unit behind the parts. This is why the 10 commandments, those are 10 sayings. But behind the 10 sayings is the will of God. There is one behind the 10. This is why when 9 Jews pray, how many Jews are praying? 9 Jews. But when 10 Jews are praying, well, how do we look at it? The collective is praying. The group is praying. Do you understand? Because 10 already represents the unit of made out of parts. That's the idea of the number 10. Okay? Now, this is the idea then of the minyan, the group. Now, when did we become an organized group? When we went out of Egypt. That's when we became a nation. Now, before that, were there chosen people before the Jews became a nation? Sure, from the days of Abraham. Right? That's a long time before the Jews became a nation. So that represents that there are two aspects of the Jew. There is the individual aspect of the Jew, and there is the collective aspect of the Jew. What is the idea? That before you bring the Paschal lamb, you have to be circumcised. Let's interpret the idea behind it. Before you make a commitment to your nation, part of the collective, you must make your personal commitment. You can't have a group commitment, a group identification with Judaism, unless you personally committed yourself to Judaism. You personally committed yourself in your relationship with God. In other words, your personal pact is a precondition to your collective pact. Okay? That's the perfect example would be, how do we look at a Jew who in his own personal life doesn't act like a Jew at all? But he does whenever there is a collective thing, a collective experience. Right? He does feel part of the Jewish people. Right? He does come to the synagogue, for instance, because that's already part of the collective. He does give money for the UJA or whatever. In his mind represents an identification with the group, with the Jewish people. Is that sufficient? How do we look at it? We say, no, it's not sufficient. Such a Jew has no future. The only future that guarantees the survival of the Jewish people is the something which is based on the personal commitment, and that precedes the collective commitment. Okay? Now, another important point. Jews can survive without the Paschal Lamb, right? We have done it for a few thousand years, no Paschal Lamb. But we do not survive without circumcision. Circumcision is still part and parcel of how Jews behave, even in exile. What does that teach us? What is the idea behind this fact? That, again, personal commitment, personal pact, is more important, precedes the collective. Okay, even though the collective is very important, it's only the second step after the personal commitment. Is this idea clear? Okay, let's go on now to the next holiday. Right, 49 days after the first day of Passover comes another holiday. Which holiday? Shavuot. And in Shavuot, we commemorate the receiving of the Torah. Now, every other holiday in the Bible has a specific date in the calendar. Rosh Hashanah, for instance, is the first day of Tishrei. Sukkot is the 15th day of Tishrei. All of them have specific dates in the calendar, except one. You guessed it, Shavuot. Shavuot has no date in the calendar. The way Shavuot is described is being the 50th day after the first day of Passover. Now, why is it this way? Why would the holiday of Shavuot be pegged to Passover? Why isn't it an independent holiday? Okay, so you say, well, because it happens to be that it was 50 days after Passover. No, but there is something more than that. Right. We find something else. There is a specific obligation to count the days between Passover and Shavuot. Why is that? Why do we have to count the days? Yeah.
Shavuot represents the culmination of a Pesach
day. All right. That's the idea behind it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Is it the spiritual levels? Right?
Again?
The spiritual levels rising from the Passover.
From Passover to Shavuot. Okay. Fine. That's exactly the point.
What's the reason for that?
Yeah. Let me just explain it exactly. The point is like this. The mitzvah to count the days between Passover and Shavuot brings out the following thought, the following idea behind it. How would you describe Passover, the holiday of what? I know, the Exodus, but what is the main experience of going out of Egypt? What's the point? What do we stress? Freedom.
Physical freedom.
The point that the Torah tries to make is that physical freedom is not an objective, it's not a goal by itself. We don't see in freedom the culmination of something. We see in freedom a very important method, a means to an end. But freedom by itself has no value whatsoever. The question is always, freedom? For what? What are you going to do with it? If you are going to utilize it in a beneficial way, then it's positive. What about if freedom by itself becomes a goal, then it's a negative force. There is nothing good in freedom by itself. So the point is like this. Shavuot is the culmination of freedom. Why? Because the whole idea of Shavuot is remembering that the Jews accepted the Torah. They accepted the obligation according to our tradition. It wasn't something that was forced upon them, the acceptance. They chose to accept it. Remember the magic statement, the famous statement that the Jews made on Mount Sinai. Na'aseh v'nishma. We shall do, we accept the obligation. And once we've accepted the obligation, then we'll hear, which means we'll try to understand. But we won't make our commitment to the Torah conditional on our understanding. We'll always try to understand. The Jew usually is very curious, he doesn't take anything for granted, he always asks questions, but the Jew asks the question after he has accepted. He doesn't make his acceptance conditional to the asking of questions. This is what the statement means. Na'aseh, we shall do, which means we commit ourselves to God, Venishma, but of course after that we'll try to understand every single detail of the Torah. We won't take anything for granted after we have accepted that. Now, this is an act of freedom. Why? Because a slave follows orders. A slave doesn't accept a responsibility. Only a free person, only to the degree that you are free, can you accept a responsibility. Therefore, it was crucial for us to go out of Egypt. What does it mean, going out of Egypt? Getting rid of the yoke of Pharaoh in order to accept willingly the yoke of God. Okay? Now, in reality, according to our tradition, Shavuot, the receiving of the Torah, should have come immediately after Passover. As a matter of fact, the next day should have been the experience of the receiving of the Torah. Except that the Jews weren't spiritually ready for that experience. Now, according to our tradition, again, we are coming back to Numbers. There are 50 gates. Did you ever hear this concept? The 50 gates of purity, or the 50 gates of impurity. Which means that, according to our tradition, there are 50 levels that a person can come down to when he's losing his human qualities. He can go so far that the extreme of it is described as the 50th level. Except that once you have reached that 50th level, it's a point of no return. It's too late. So the last point of impurity, of corruption, that is possible to come back from, is considered what?
49.
The 49th level. Okay? So this is why when we are describing the spiritual corruption of the Jews in Egypt, it went to such an extreme that we describe it as having reached the 49th level of impurity. In order to point this out, how far we had gone in Egypt, and how far we had to come back in order to be ready to receive the Torah obligates us to count each one of the days as if to say that each day represents a going away from that extreme of impurity in order to be ready to accept the Torah. This is the idea of counting. Okay? So, what do we hear from all this? That the culmination of Passover is Shavuot. Passover without Shavuot would have no meaning in Judaism. It would be physical freedom without any benefit from it, without any usage, without anything positive coming out of it. So that is not freedom according to the Torah. This is why Passover without Shavuot has no meaning. But the same goes for the other way around. Shavuot, if it's not preceded by Passover, again has no meaning. If we are not free, we can't accept the responsibility of serving God. Yeah, somebody wanted to... Yeah.
So, you would consider Shavuos the Chol HaMoed of Passover?
Well, we would consider the days between Passover and Shavuot as a type of Chol HaMoed, like the days between holidays.
So that's why you wouldn't count, you wouldn't have a specific day for Shavuos. Like, you don't have a specific day
for the last day
of
Sukkot, for instance. Exactly. That's the idea. Because Shavuot is not an independent holiday, because as an independent holiday, it has no meaning. It's all one with Passover. It's two independent parts of one whole. Yeah.
You said that a man who is only physically free is in a position to accept duties and responsibilities. Why is that so?
Because someone who is a slave can only follow orders. He doesn't take on responsibilities. Taking on responsibilities is an outcome of my decision, of my taking on, my sensing values, what's important. A slave only reacts to the scale of values of his master. Right? A slave is only the utensil of the master. The more I make my own decisions, the freer I am. As a matter of fact, this is the way we describe freedom. We don't consider a person who is free to take drugs, and he takes drugs, and then he becomes hooked on them. Would you consider him a free person? We don't, because he's not weighing, he's not judging the values of in his life, his actions, what's important, what's not important. He becomes a slave to his desires. So there is no basic difference to us whether a person is legally free, but in reality he's a slave to his desires or his instincts or his impulses. Such a person is as much of a slave as a person who is in jail. Right? Or a person who is sold as a slave and is following the orders of the master. So only that kind of a freedom which allows you to weigh and make decisions based on the relative value of what you are deciding upon, only such a person is really free. Okay? Yeah.
How is the important levels of impurity that the Jews were in when they left Egypt? But they were slaves in Egypt, so how come they became so impure? I mean, what, I didn't understand.
Well, it's one of the same. You see, through slavery, you cease to use your judgment. The first thing which is lost by a slave is his sense of value, his judgment, weighing one thing against the other. A slave will automatically try to imitate his master. And this is what the Jews did. Their whole life was imitating their master. The more we can be like our masters, the more of a chance we have not to be slaves, to be like them. And that distortion pushed them down to the lowest level of impurity. Meaning, their Jewish scale of values was almost completely lost. Yeah.
So they were down at the 49th level, one way from the return, and then they went up, you know, counting the 49 days, going up, that
right.
would take us up to zero.
Again?
It would take, from negative 49, it would take us up to zero.
Right, right.
And is there any kind of extension from there that you're supposed to be going up further? Or?
Exactly. So the point is that Shavuot is really one step beyond that. It's the 50th day, okay? Which means that Shavuot represents a commitment of no return, which is, according to our tradition, the commitment of the Jews to Torah. It is a commitment of no return. Even though individually every person has the choice whether he wants to be part of that commitment or not, but as a nation, we have the guarantee that we cannot survive without the keeping of the Torah. For instance, we believe that if all Jews would just all together will decide, you know what? From tomorrow on, we don't keep any of the laws of the Torah anymore. We don't study Torah anymore. That's it. Finished. No keeping of the Sabbath, not putting on phylacteries, nothing. We believe with absolute belief that the Jewish people would automatically disappear. Not only that, we go one step further. Because you know what the pact was between Abraham and God. We mentioned this a few a while ago. You know what the pact was? From Abram's side, the commitment was, I take upon myself to transfer my commitment to God to future generations. This is what Abram took upon himself. To my children, so that they will transfer it to their children, and so on and so forth forever. What was God's side of that pact? Right, a pact needs two sides.
I will keep the reserve the Jewish people so they can keep this.
Exactly, because Abram is only a human being. He can't guarantee his success. God can guarantee success, and God guaranteed his success, which is, as long as you keep trying to transfer the commitment, you will succeed. And more, as long as there are human beings in the world, there will be Jews in the world. That's a guarantee. Right? So this is it's very important that Jews who believe in the Torah are never worried about what's going to happen to Judaism. Never worried. Judaism is guaranteed. It has the best guarantee. What traditional Jews are worried about is what will happen to individual Jews, because Judaism can be kept by a small group of Jews. What will happen with individual Jews? So we worry. I'd like you to be part of that group. I'd like you to be part of the group. I'd like you to be part of the group. We are worried about Jews, not about Judaism. Right? It's interesting. People who don't believe in that commitment of God that Judaism is guaranteed, they are worried about Judaism. This is why other sects, other movements within Judaism do things because they are really worried what's going to happen to Judaism. Like, for instance, they say, well, if we are going to be so strict about the keeping of the laws of the Torah, eventually nobody's going to keep them. So let's make it easier for for Jews to keep Judaism. Let's allow them certain things. They want to come to the synagogue. If you tell them that they can't drive to the synagogue, nobody will come to the synagogue, and then the whole Judaism will disappear. So we have to make it easier for them. So let's allow them to drive on the Sabbath. Right? What is that? An expression of worry about what? About Judaism. What's going to be with Judaism? You see, traditional Judaism has no worry. They don't worry about Judaism. So therefore, we don't tamper with Judaism, because Judaism is what it is. That's all. We don't tamper with it in order to save it. We know that Judaism is going to be saved. What does traditional Judaism worry about? The individual Jews. So they try to bring them closer to their tradition. So this is the major difference between traditional Judaism's attitude towards the future of Judaism and the other movement. The other movements are very, very worried. And right of distortions in the law in order to save Judaism from its extinction.
What he was talking about, he said that they were 49 levels below in Tuma. What, the way I got explained by my Rebbe was that the 49 days that they came out of Egypt and they were going to get the Torah, these 49 days, each day they rose above a level of Tuma, and at the same time they gained a level of purity, and simultaneously they moved up the ladder. So on the 50th day, when they were going to get the Torah, they were on the 50th level of purity, so they were spiritually high enough so they could receive the Torah.
Right, but I just like to clarify. Don't take it literally that every day they went up one step. It just means that symbolically, every day represents a rising of one step. Obviously, some Jews did it in one day. Some Jews, unfortunately, even at the end, weren't 100% ready for it. We are just representing an idea with the days. You see, that's the concept is that every day makes you aware of how far we went. But it doesn't mean that every day. There are many Jews. It says that 7 days after the coming out of Egypt was the crossing of the Red Sea, which was what such an intense prophetic experience that at that time they were ready to accept the Torah, so to speak. So it's not so exact that every day was an actual rising of another level, but it's representative of the 49 levels. Okay? Yeah.
So, say about their descent into the 49th level and their assimilation into the Egyptian culture, but I thought it was supposed to be that the Jews didn't make any compromises, that they kept on slowly in their own names.
Yeah, we mentioned it the other day. It is an apparent contradiction that you are pointing out. On the one hand, it says that 1 second later, we would have been in the 50th level of impurity, which means the point of no return, that means complete assimilation. On the other hand, we have another statement in the oral tradition, which says they did keep certain things which made them identify with Judaism, which is the Jewish language, the Hebrew language. They taught their children the Hebrew language. Besides the Egyptian language, of course. I mean, everybody knew Egyptian. But besides knowing Egyptian, they did not ignore the Hebrew language. And every Jew, perhaps they also had Egyptian names, but they also had Jewish names. And they also wore special Jewish garments, like Jewish insignias. So you are right, on the surface it does seem like a contradiction. If they had such a close identification with Judaism, why were they in such a danger of disappearing?
Because so the large majority had drifted off.
Well, it's not only that, it's something much, much deeper, you see. Because Jews had those external signs of identification with Judaism, that many of them ease their feelings of guilt by doing that. Like, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. Look, you know, I put on Jewish garments, you see, my flag, my insignia, right? Or, you see, I teach my children Hebrew, and then what? Well, then I can do whatever I want, right? It's like the Jew today, he has a few external signs of identification with the Jewish people, and the rest of his life is a Gentile life. He lives 100% a Gentile life. There is nothing in his everyday life that shows a difference between Jew and Gentile, right? He eats the same thing, he acts the same way, he says the same things, right? But because of those few external signs of identification, he says, look, you know, I am a Jew. So as long as I am a Jew, I don't feel guilty about acting like a non-Jew. Do you see what I mean? That, as a matter of fact, serves as a rationalization for your not committing yourself to Judaism, those external signs. This is exactly what happened. When somebody would come and say to them, what do you mean, you don't keep the Jewish values, you don't teach your children Jewish values, but I teach Hebrew, but I give my children a Jewish name. It's as if that is a justification for everything else. That distorted the whole real values of Judaism by the Jewish people. In a way, it became a reason why they assimilated so much. Because in the back of their minds, that feeling of guilt, right, disappeared because of those external signs of identification. Yes, how do you... Well, it counts for Yeah, it counts for a lot if you recognize that that is not the whole thing. But when that external sign becomes the only thing, then it's counterproductive. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, right? It's like the Jew who says, well, my commitment to Judaism is that I visit the synagogue once a year on Yom Kippur. Wouldn't it be better if he wouldn't come to the synagogue on Yom Kippur? That would make him face his Judaism and make a decision. Am I Jewish or am I not Jewish? Like this, because he comes once a year to the synagogue, that rationalizes for him not being a Jew the rest of the year, as long as I can keep my visiting the synagogue.
If he has one great experience with God on Yom Kippur, how can he demean that? And then maybe that's for the greater good. Maybe that's okay.
Fine. I mean, we are not putting it down. Sometimes that experience is very valuable, very positive. I'm just giving you an example of how that positive experience can become counterproductive. It can become a negative experience because it creates in him a rationalization for everything else. That's the problem. Okay? Yeah.
I have a question of, can we look at the Omer this way? We have the 49 days, and it's divided into two parts. The first part would be Pesach, then a day between, and then 40 days. We can see the 40 days between the two holidays as parallel to the 40 years. Is that legitimate to look at it that way?
Well, it is legitimate, and I'll tell you why. Because you just mentioned another number, the number 40, right? And you want to...
We're not counting 40 days, we're counting 49. That's my question.
Right.
So is it legitimate to break them off that way, to say Passover, day between, and then?
Right. There is a point to it, which means 49 has in it the 7 days the first day of Passover. Then you have the 7 days, and then you have the 40 days. I just want to clarify that the number 40, I remember we spoke about the importance of the numbers. You know what the number 40 always represents? Number 40 always represents complete change from one extreme to another. When do we ever find number 40 in our tradition? When do we find number 40? The flood. What was the point of the flood? Changing the world from a corrupt world to a pure world took 40 days. Where else do you have a number 40? Yeah?
Oh, as I mentioned, 40 years.
Right, the 40 years in the desert. The changing from a slave mentality to being ready to go into the land of Israel and establish our own land, right? From one extreme to another takes 40 years.
40
exactly, the change of the 40.
The
40 days that Moses, right, had to prepare himself he had to become from a human being into a receiver of Torah, like a spiritual being. Also, it takes 40 days. And the Talmud says that a fetus from nothing into a something. You know when a fetus is considered a legal fetus in Judaism?
40
days after conception. Why? Again, because it has to change from a something into an entity. So it takes 40. So the number 40 is very closely attached to this idea of complete change. Yeah?
Isn't 40 years period of time you're allowed to be in your own age, 20 to 60, right?
You're right. Right. The 40 years serving the community. Doesn't mean actually in the army fighting, but it means serving the community, right? You have to be ready between the ages of 20 and 60, right?
And the age 40 to begin learning Kabbalah.
Right, right. It mentions that at the age 40, there is a major change by you. The Gemara, the Mishnah says that Bina, that special characteristic, a special level of understanding, you reach at age 40 only. Yeah.
Is there 40 days of fasting as a punishment for something?
Certain times, certain people, right, we find the number 40 attached to the days of atonement. 40 days of atonement, right? The 40 days. Again, that has to do with this concept of complete change. Yeah.
Then they say 40 minus 1 of the malachas, and it's also 40 minus 1 for the malachas. Right?
Well, that, again, has a very special meaning. When the Torah describes the lashes, you know, there are certain transgressions that the punishment for it is lashes in court, right? Not that the lashes hurt so much, it was more symbolical, really, right? They used to, according to one opinion in the Talmud, they would choose the weakest member of the court and the thinnest type of material of strap in order he should hurt the least. But the idea was to make him aware of his transgression. And they in the Torah it says 40, that you give him 40 lashes. And the oral tradition says 40 minus 1. That means up to 40, but not including the 40. And the commentaries say, what's behind this idea? That you can give him 40. You know what they say it is? Because the whole purpose is that you should change yourself. Not that the lashes should change you. That the lashes should make you aware of the need for change. So which is the number that represents change?
40.
So the 40th should be your own. It shouldn't come from the outside. This is why the lashes can only be 39. Because the purpose is not to change. The purpose is to make you ready to change. This is why the Torah calls it 40, because it hints to the idea of change. But the Torah doesn't want you to give him 40 lashes. The Torah wants him to recognize himself that he needs to change.
What's the additional 10 days of the Omer? If 39 would have been enough, why did we go 40?
So that's what I'm saying. The idea is 49 because of the levels of impurity. Right. That is the idea behind the number 49. But yeah.
I have one more question about 49. You mentioned that 7 represents creation. So if we take 49, we see that it equals 7 times itself. So is this a special kind of creation? It's creation times itself?
Well, not exactly. The idea is that whenever we find the number 7, as you mentioned correctly, it has to do with a natural cycle. Natural cycle is always associated with number 7. Even 7 times 7 is a natural cycle. Do you know what I'm talking about? The sabbatical year in Judaism is what? Once every 7 years. But after you've gone through 7 times 7, what comes?
The Jubilee
year. Right? Where things go back to their original state. Things like start all over again. Right? Slaves go free. Lands go back to their original owner. Right? So the number 50 is a breakaway from the natural cycle. We also find there is a parallel between the number 8 and the number 50, by the way. There is a very close connection between the number 8 and the number 50. Because if 7 represents the natural cycle, then what should 8 represent? One above it, breaking out of the natural cycle. This is why the commentaries say circumcision is on which day? The 8th day, because it represents the supernatural sort of survival of the Jew. According to the natural cycles, the Jew should have disappeared a long time ago. Right? According to the natural laws of history, people like the Jews, right, so should have disappeared a long time ago. Their survival is beyond the natural cycle of 7. Okay, the same thing that the number 50 represents, breaking out of the 7 times 7, the cycle within the cycle. This is why the receiving of the Torah breaks out of the natural cycle. Right? It's reaching a level of spirituality which is not part of the natural cycle. So this is what the meaning of breaking out of the number 49. 49 and 7 are very closely connected, except that 7 is the thing in itself, the cycle in itself, and the 49 is the cycle within a cycle, which is basically the same thing. Yeah, so you understand. Exactly, Hanukkah you mentioned. The miracle of Hanukkah. How many days again?
8
days. What's the idea behind it? Again, survival. Survival against all odds. That is the whole miracle of Hanukkah. And the commentaries make the clear connection between circumcision, the 8th day, and Hanukkah, 8 days, which is the commemoration of Jewish survival against the tremendous power of the Greek influence. Remember, in those days, they were so powerful. I mean, I don't mean physically. I mean, the ideology, the Greek ideology, the Greek culture, the Greek way of life was so overwhelmingly strong that every other nation which was under Greek domination just took on their customs, their values, except the Jews. They couldn't break the Jews. That was what we would consider a supernatural survival of the Jew. Yeah.
Rav Akiva also started studying at the age of 40, right?
Well, the major change in Rabbi Akiva's life was at the age of 40, right? Which, again, is not a coincidence at all. Okay? Now, just one clarification. When we say that the Torah was received on Sinai, do you know what we mean by that? Many people mistakenly think that the book that we call the Torah, this is what was received in Sinai.
No, they say that it came from Sinai.
What?
Received from Sinai.
Well, it was accepted in Sinai, but it wasn't received in Sinai, which means the book did not exist as such, as a readable book, until many, many years later, until 40 years later.
Until every day.
Right before the death of Moshe, this is when we receive the book as it exists today. But what was received in Sinai was, first of all, the Jewish people received the so-called Ten Commandments, the Ten Sayings. And Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, received in Sinai the laws, not the Torah not the Torah the way we have it, but the laws of the Torah were given to Moshe in Sinai, and as they went through the desert in the 40 years, he explained that to the Jewish people, okay, and portions
orally,
and until finally it all became part of the certain things became part of the written law, but a lot remained oral, right, until the Mishnah was written down. A large portion of what was given to Moshe in Sinai remained oral. Only certain things were written down, sufficient things were written down to give us information about what happened to our ancestors in the desert, and enough hints concerning different oral laws, but the great majority of the details of how to fulfill the commandments were kept orally. Yeah?
You said that only the laws were given in Sinai. Does that mean that all the stories in the Torah were made up by Moshe?
What do you mean?
They happened from
which stories? The stories after Sinai or before Sinai?
Before Sinai.
The stories before Sinai were given in Sinai. They had a book in Sinai. There was a book, but it wasn't the book that we have. It was called Sefer HaBrit, the book of the pact, which included what we know as Genesis and some portion of Exodus. That's all that existed till Sinai. And that was a holy book, but it's not the Torah that we have. Okay? Yeah.
How do they know that they got just that first part?
Again, how do we know?
Yeah.
It's safer, as a matter of fact, if you take a look in Exodus, it does call it the Sefer HaBrit, the book of the pact. And if you take a look in the commentary of Rashi, right there, we're quoting from the oral tradition, he says that included Genesis and the portion of Exodus up to Sinai. Okay? Yeah.
So the stories that are written in the Torah...
From those stories which take place after Sinai...
They take place, and all along there was a historian that was writing these down as it occurred?
Not necessarily. We know that Moses prophetically... I mean, there is an opinion which says that as things happened, portions were added to the Torah. The Torah slowly developed. But there is an opinion which says that only at the end of the life of Moses, right? As a matter of fact, that's the way it sounds from the Torah itself. Right before the death of Moshe, it says that he wrote the Torah, right? Through the prophecy.
Right there, he wrote. He didn't
write there. Right there, right at the end.
And they say that the Jews believed, the traditional Jews believed that God used Moshe as like a writing tool, as a pencil.
Exactly.
Exactly. So how could he do that if these were occurrences in his lifetime? I mean, God had already planned these things to happen to him?
What do you mean? He was told to write them after they happened. After they happened, at the end of his life.
At the end of his life.
That's when he wrote the Torah the way we know it, yeah?
But he wasn't the author. God was the author.
Of course. I mean, that's what prophecy is all about. The prophecy of Moses is that he became a tool of the Word of God. Meaning he had such an intense prophecy that he was able to focus exactly on the words of God, something which didn't happen to other prophets. Other prophets dressed up their insights, their prophetic insights, into their own words. They covered the insights with their own words, not by Moses. Moses was able to focus on the word in itself.
So these stories, so God created these stories, or God made these things happen. So we can learn from these stories?
That's the idea. That's the purpose. But remember, Torah is not a history book. Yeah. Torah is what it says it is. What does the word Torah mean?
Instruction.
Lesson. That's the whole purpose. It's not a history book. It's not in order to satisfy our historical curiosity.
According to our tradition, Moses wrote down the Torah as he next to God, that is, Hashem was the author of it. How do we explain the pseudonym anomaly where
says that God spoke to Moses saying in the third person, and not the first person. God spoke to him saying.
That's what I'm saying, meaning he saw those words, right? Meaning he focused, his prophetic insights focused on those words, right? So when he wrote it, he didn't write it as an author. He wrote it as the tool of God's will. Exactly. Exactly. That's the whole point. So when he sees the words Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, and God spoke to Moshe, this is what he writes. Like, he doesn't see himself as taking part in the process of writing of the Torah. He sees himself as something which is just duplicating the will of God.
The same thing. You write a book today and you have a copyright. You can't just say I'm saying this.
Yeah.
Was the same kind of brief then? Was it written right after the revelation of Sinai, or was it carrying on even before?
It doesn't say clearly. The one thing it does say clearly is that they hid it on Sinai. It doesn't say exactly when it was written. Was it written on Sinai, or they hid it from before? But it does say that they hid it on Sinai. Okay, cool. Step in.